Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1024.GN2917, certificate number 24193. The Rachel.
I mean, maybe you were on the right track with that whole, you know, spontaneous thing. I mean, women really like that.
Really?
I mean, if it were me, I'd want you to...
What?
I don't know, I'd catch me off guard, you know, with like a really good kiss. You know, really... sort of, soft at first. And then maybe, brush the hair away from my face. And then look far into my eyes in a way that lets me know something amazing is about to happen.
So, the Rachel is a haircut. In the early 1990s, using our archaic dating system, there was a popular television show called Friends that became internationally popular. It wasn't just popular in America because it represented an idealized version of what would happen if six young white people lived together in implausibly nice apartments in New York City and seemingly hardly ever went to work, spent most of their time lying around, which is actually how I spent the 90s, but I wasn't quite as beautiful. And one of the characters in the show, played by the actress Jennifer Aniston, was named Rachel Green. And Rachel, at the end of the first season, but certainly throughout the second season, rocked a haircut. That's how we described it at the time.
You in the future, if you have hair, probably merely have haircuts.
Right, or wear a hairstyle.
But we rock them.
Some of us rocked them. And Rachel Green certainly rocked this haircut, which now, and certainly to futurelings, just looks like a normal haircut. There is nothing about this haircut that, to our modern eyes, would suggest how radical it seemed and how much it overtook the culture in its time.
Well, let me remind you of the premise here, John. We're talking to hypothetical future people, possibly millennia hence, about essential bits of our culture that we fear may be lost to the mists and the sands of time.
Right.
Why does a haircut from a 1990s television series so delight and inspire you? I have to know.
Well, because it really swept the world implausibly. It was a haircut that didn't exist and then did exist and I think transformed the culture even more than the show initially.
I think we can all remember when British Prime Minister Tony Blair had the Rachel, for example.
But there have been
several
instances,
astronauts.
There have been instances of this throughout our culture over time. Certainly in the 20th century, periodically an actress would wear her hair a certain way and it would sweep the nation. And it was a psychological phenomenon as much as anything.
It's some kind of mass hypnosis, you think? Well, I must have that hair.
Well, where the hair cut represented something bigger than just the style.
Ah, it's the life.
It's the life. The haircut suggests a kind of freedom. It's often a sort of freedom or a sort of location in time.
You know what I'm picturing when you say this is like Louise Brooks's 20s bob.
That's exactly a perfect example. Louise Brooks's Bob.
Because you don't just see, that's a short, unconventional haircut. You see, look at all that fun she's having with her unconventional bohemian life and her friends in Vienna and whatever she's doing in this silent movie. And, you know, you can't have that.
Right.
You can't move to Vienna.
Or you can if...
Right. You can go to your hairdresser.
And when you think about Louise Brooks, just prior to that, I mean, all through the 19th century and into the early 20th century, there was only really one way for a woman to wear her hair, which was grown all the way out and then pinned up in an elaborate sort of architecture. I mean, there wasn't really a woman's haircut. It was just long.
Is that true? Like women would, their hair would just be as long as it got and you would just do your best with that?
You would braid it or you would pin it up or you would wear it under a hat, but...
But everybody had fundamentalist big love hair.
Yeah, because it was just, I mean, at the time, there wasn't another suggestion. And what was so revolutionary about the flappers was both that they were liberated by cutting their hair short. And that kind of, it wasn't just a middle finger to the patriarchy, but it was also, I mean, I don't know if you, well, obviously you've never worn long hair, given that you are a masculine icon.
Given that I've had this haircut since I was, you know, my 7-year-old childhood portraits at Sears. That's when men choose their haircuts, basically.
You walk into any barbershop in America and say, haircut, please.
I'll have one haircut. I have a little coupon that says haircut on it.
Well, your cheapest haircut, please.
Hey.
I mean, there are haircuts that cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And let me just say to the future listener, yours is not one, right? What do you pay for a haircut?
The one I have right now?
Yeah, between $20 and $40.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's right. So the flapper, the liberation of the flappers was they had short hair. They also raised the hemline of their dresses all the way up to their knee. And you could suddenly be thin. Like the fashion of flappers was to not have a bust or a bustier, but have this sort of thin line body style.
The bust and bustier are two different things. I guess I don't know my 1930s words for sexual secondary characteristics.
I mean, your bust is the bust, is your actual physical
the
architecture,
breasts.
Yourself, right?
I think we can say breasts on this podcast.
It's
not one of the 7 words you can't say to future listeners.
Your breasts are your bust, whereas the bustier is the lingerie that accentuates the bust.
Oh, I see.
Right?
I thought the second thing was going to be like you couldn't have a big caboose.
Well, that's a bustle.
Ah.
Confusingly.
Why do they all have bust in the name?
It's very unclear.
Was that the most sexual syllable people could think of
well,
at the turn of the century?
I read a thing not very long ago where some archaeologist or some cultural anthropologist was suggesting that the site of buttocks was the original sort of like sex allure, or the first aphrodisiac was the sight of buttocks sort of maybe running away from you.
Or raised in surrender. I've actually heard that's where the heart comes from. The shape of a Valentine heart may be the shape
of a bottom.
The thing you want to see the most, somebody's bottom raised.
And so the bust, the bustier, is a way of taking the breasts and making them look like a buttocks.
Is there any way to make me look more? So it's like walking in with a coupon that says, can you please make my chest look more like a butt?
Yeah. Please. Give me a front butt, please, in addition to a back butt, because I would like to stand and have people look at me from the front.
I want to be admired. I would like to have butts covering the entire surface area of my body. That's always been my dream.
Right. So just prior to the flapper era, the ideal female form within the culture was a very narrow waist.
An hourglass. You've got some kind of under bodice or something underpinning your skirt that makes it poof out.
Yeah, it was made of metal and
you couldn't get through doors.
Whalebone.
Like Scarlett O'Hara trying to get through a door. She's like turning sideways.
And then all of a sudden, all of that is swept away and you have the short hair. And so it was truly a liberation.
And it's
fashion.
I guess I often think of it as sort of a gender bending thing, like, ooh, Louise Brooks has short hair, you know. What's going on? So say goodbye, gender roles.
Yeah.
Or with skirts being shorter, you know, it's a little more sexualized. But I guess you're making it sound like there's a convenience angle, right?
Well,
like,
so if you so I have worn my hair very long. Over the years, several times I've grown my hair down to the middle of my back. as part of a rock and roll lifestyle. Sometimes it's just because I stopped caring for myself, and other times it was, yeah, largely because I stopped caring for myself.
But a lot of people don't know about your hairband era.
Well, you know, I hennaed my hair at some point too, but like even now for a guy, I wear my hair a little long. I mean, it's not quite a Rachel, but it's,
You're making fun of my strip mall haircut, but you, I believe, cut your own hair.
I do cut my own hair.
Is that true?
I do. And we, for two men in our middle age, we still both have all our hair, which is
right.
Which is a thing to, I don't know, to note at least.
Do you know the numbers on male pattern baldness? There's a rule of thumb where your odds of having male pattern baldness are essentially the same as your age.
What?
Like 18% of 18-year-olds are already going bald.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes. But unfortunately, you know, 68% of 68-year-olds are going bald. And that's why when you turn 101, you're guaranteed, you're super bald. That's when you goes off the scale. You start making other people bald.
My uncle went bald at 22, right? Which, I mean, fully bald, which happens to a certain percentage of people. But you and I don't even really have thinning hair. We're still both pretty hirsute.
I'm getting to the point where, like, in summer, I can get a sunburn in a place I did not used to get a sunburn on top, which is maybe the first sign. But I feel like we're doing Jennifer Aniston a disservice by talking about our own unfashionable hair.
Well, so if you have long, long hair, and particularly if you have thick hair, that hair weighs a lot. Carrying, and, you know, your head and neck are strong, but you're adding, in some cases, 5 extra pounds of hair. Ungainly hair.
So it's not just styling time. You're actually like a beast of burden if the patriarchy is making you have this crazy Gibson girl hair.
And so I think during the flapper era, when you cut off that 5 extra pounds of hair, you feel lighter. You feel unburdened of your patrimony. And you really are free to dance the jitterbug to the jazz.
You could do the Charleston on a table.
You could do... That's right. Coney Island washboard. She can do the Charleston on the boardwalk all the time.
If I could lose 5 pounds by getting a more convenient haircut, I would do it immediately. That's like living the dream on so many axes.
But then styles changed, right? And then in the 40s, you had sort of unusual coifs that were quite a bit longer. Hair grew out again. I think all the way through the Depression, all the way through the 1930s, like chin-length bobs were still pretty in fashion if you were a Dust Bowl Okey headed out to the West.
Or even a man if you're Prince Valiant.
Right? but then in the 40s, hair got long again. And then in the 50s, you know, Marilyn Monroe and Gina Lollobrigida kept their hair kind of head-shaped.
It's very curled and coiffed and up, right?
Right. And then in the mid-60s, you had this phenomenon of Twiggy and Mia Farrow and Goldie Hawn.
Twiggy.
Who introduced a really short haircut, like a boy's haircut, into the fashion.
Twiggy has to be explained now, right? Like I guess it was the same thing as Louise Brooks, you know, like, you know, it was all a bombshell Jane Mansfield type figures.
Right.
And the new London style was Twiggy, who is actually named for the fact that she is a stick-like svelte figure.
Super tall with no curves. No curves at all, and a boy's haircut. So a truly androgynous fashion model of the mid-60s.
And she becomes famous through the haircut. Did you know this? She went to this fashionable Mayfair hairdresser to get her haircut, and he gives her this sort of very cutting-edge boy's cut, pixie cut that nobody had, and puts the picture up in his shop, and that's when fashion editors see the thing and say, who is this? Is that a model? You know? So she had the haircut first and then became famous. Audrey.
Well, now Audrey Hepburn also had a short haircut, but not that short, right?
Yeah. What's her most pixie-ish haircut? Like
Breakfast at Tiffany's. She had long hair for Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah. Her shortest hair is like when she's like in Funny Face with Fred Astaire, when she's sort of like a elfin dancer type.
Right.
But that actually predates Twiggy slightly,
but still it's not quite that, a little longer in the back. Yeah. And then the response to that, or then culturally by the late 60s, again, long straight
flower child
hair.
And my assumption about all this, and maybe I'm wrong, is that it's all a huge scam. Am I just too cynical that you know, there's no profit to be made if people are always wearing the same kinds of clothes? I mean, people will always need haircuts, but you can get people to buy clothes more and cut their hair more if there's a cycle, right?
Well, we live in a world which is curiously post-fashion cycle in a lot of ways.
Is it, or does it just seem that way to us?
No, I think it is, because right now you are wearing clothes that 20 years ago would have communicated exactly what they communicate now, a plaid shirt over a t-shirt with some rock dudes on it. And that was the look of people.
And Levi's. Like the most timeless, like this is what you wore in a time machine, basically.
Yeah, that was what you would have worn in 1975, right? 35 years ago. So something happened in the 90s where fashion just fell in upon itself. And if you want to dress like Twiggy today, or you want to dress like Louise Brooks, or you want to dress like a Gibson girl,
nobody will bat an eye, right?
Right, because all fashion is equally valid now. But what that means is that there isn't any new look, or, you know, the brand new look for 1962.
Wow. Does that mean the Rachel was the last Rachel? Like, the Rachel was it, as far as maybe possibly in history, the last look that everyone had to have?
Well, so that's kind of...
That's the end of the monoculture?
That's my suggestion, right? That the Rachel swept the world, and now we live in a post-Rachel world where the Rachel continues to be a haircut that you can go into a salon and wear. And if you go online and look, there are all the... Because there's still, obviously, a lot of fashion industry. There are a lot of fashion blogs. But you can find multiple instances over the last 20 years where someone would write a magazine article saying, "The Rachel is back." And it basically happens every 3 years. The Rachel is back. And for a certain sort of shape of face, the Rachel never went out of style. You can still, I mean, it's sort of, we think of it now as maybe a suburban mom haircut, but I think it's still, I think it was potentially the last monoculture haircut.
My theory is we tried everything.
Well,
like once there's one of everything out there, you know, it's impossible to come up with the new eye-catching look. Like when I was a kid watching, you know, sort of early 70s TV that was, you know, predated me by maybe half a generation, you know, looking at the wide lapels and pant legs and neckties on Barney Miller or whatever, I would just laugh and laugh and think, good thing we in the 80s with our skinny ties know better, you know?
Tiny collars.
Right. And I don't think that's possible anymore. You know, now you look at a TV show 10 or 20 years ago and you think, oh, those are all looks that still exist because we tried all the extreme fashions. Ties went as wide as they could go and narrow as they could go. And now every time you see somebody try something with a tie, it's not a new thing.
Well, so
we've tried all the possibilities.
You do see now a cycle, right? Like for the last 5 years in menswear, the style has been tiny lapels, tiny collars, tiny ties.
Very trim. Don Draper influence kind of a fitted thing, right?
And like high water pants and short sleeves, like really what you would call an ill-fitting suit by typical standards. If you look at James Bond in the last James Bond movie, where he's running out in the desert somewhere in the Atacama Desert.
Probably.
Wearing a tuxedo. It is, by traditional menswear standards, a completely ill-fitting tuxedo. You see all this shirt between the bottom button of the jacket and the top of the pants. Like, the pants are low-rise. I mean, none of this is what you would call a good-looking suit.
That's the kind of thing that looks fashion-forward 4 or 5 minutes. You know, right. You're like, ah, oh, good, James Bond has the newest thing, but then dates immediately, and suddenly it's Roger Moore in a powder blue tux.
So I keep saying to people who are like, I'm going to go buy a suit, I'm like, do not get a fashionable suit. You're going to look idiotic in 2 years, because this, you know, the center can't hold with this style.
Is it worth it trying to look fashionable? You get 2 years of being Daniel Craig. You get 2 years of people dressing like you. You get 2 years of Jennifer Aniston facing a world full of duplicates. How horrifying that must be for her, by the way.
Well, so Jennifer Aniston has recently, fairly recently, within the last 5 or 6 years, come out on record as having hated the Rachel haircut.
What?
Even though it was... You could make a case that it was the thing that made her famous. She was the standout star of Friends, which was an ensemble show where each one of the 6 cast members got equal screen time.
And she was not the famous one at the time.
At the time, the famous one was Courtney Cox.
People had seen Courtney Cox in the Bruce Springsteen Dancing in the Dark video.
That's right, which I always thought was a video that was a legitimate live video where he pulled a legitimately cute girl out of the audience to dance with.
I will pick America's Next Sitcom Sweetheart for I Am the Boss.
But in fact, she was somebody's niece, you know, some like executive producer's niece. And that whole thing was
It was a setup.
I mean, obviously it was a setup. If you look at it now, it's clearly a setup. But at the time, I still thought that Bruce Springsteen was real, and that somehow you could be making a live music video with seven cameras.
You thought he actually got fired from the plant after he got back from Vietnam.
That's right.
You thought all the things in his song actually happened.
He was driving around in an old Studebaker.
I can't believe they shut down the cannery. Bruce thinks to himself as he heads out on stage.
So she resented the haircut, and probably that's understandable, right? Like, just in the way that Kurt Cobain resented the fact that he became a star, even though, of course, that's all he wanted before he became a star.
I'm glad Jennifer Aniston shouldered through. I'm glad she did not leave a bloodied Rachel in her greenhouse.
The thing is, if you look at Friends, which went over the course of 10 seasons, she abandons the Rachel haircut really after the first couple of seasons. She starts growing her hair out, and for the remainder of the show, I mean, there are Rachel-y aspects to her hair, but mostly she grows it out, and at some point in the show, it's quite long. So she didn't... I'm sure she was under considerable pressure to keep the Rachel as long as she could because it was her signature, but she got away from that hair as fast as she could.
How terrible. Like, imagine a network sending you notes about how they, you know,
yeah,
they've done the math and...
Hair seems a little long, Jennifer.
This is, your personal grooming is affecting our ratings in Topeka.
But I feel like once it had gained a foothold and became a ubiquitous haircut, you could almost look at her and project a Rachel upon her, even though her hair wasn't a Rachel yet.
She still has her inner Rachel, the aura of the Rachel.
And the story was that her hairdresser was stoned that day and feeling kind of his stony oats and was like, let's do something new.
Chris McMillan, yeah, he was loaded when he gave me the haircut. Stoned out of his mind, so... true. And he didn't think about, like, oh, she's going to have to do this herself. I'm having a great time being creative with this blow dryer, and then leaves me with a round brush and a hair dryer. I don't know how to make it look like that. I just, you know.
And so, yeah, he claims that he was, over the course of a little while working with her, trying to grow her bangs out, and had gotten to a place where, well, her bangs were half grown out, and the rest of her hair was sort of, you know, longer in the back, and it sort of looked unkempt. And he was trying to give her a haircut that incorporated half-grown-out bangs. Well, let's take a break and think about that, and we'll be right back. So we should say to the futurelings what this hair looks like.
I don't know what this hair looks like. Like, if you told me, draw a Rachel, I don't know if I could, like, as a police artist, I don't think I could do it. What qualifies as a Rachel? Because you're right, it seems like just some fairly unremarkable woman's haircut.
What I think made it revolutionary was that it was two haircuts at once. It was long hair in the back, but not a mullet, obviously, but it was long. But then in the front, around the face, it was kind of cut like a bob. So the hair that framed her chin and framed the side of her face was shorter. And not so much shorter, I mean, but not bangs, right? It's still red as long hair, but it had this other element that if you look at it this way, with depth from the front to the back, it's quite a bit shorter in the front than it is in the back.
Which would be unusual for a woman's hairstyle.
At the time. I mean, there were shag haircuts throughout the 70s where it's sort of shorter on top and choppy. You know, you think about the Joan Jett or the Chrissy Hynde haircut. Right. That was a unisex haircut. That's also what Mark Bolan wore. Or, you know, it was a modish 70s rocker haircut. But those were worn quite a bit differently. The short hair was quite a bit shorter, and the long hair was quite a bit longer. So it also read as long hair, but had short elements on the top that kind of stuck out and were spiky. And then Farrah Fawcett had a very similarly influential haircut in the late 70s. Which we ended up calling feathered hair.
Right.
Which was also sort of shorter in the front and on the sides than in the back, but it was very meticulously brushed back in a kind of way that looked like the feathers of a bird.
And that was not a thing, feathered hair.
No, and it was radical in 77, 78, and 9, such that it swept the nation.
People would ask for the Farrah.
Yeah.
Hey,
that and she was famous for her hair.
And that's funny, the Rachel is the name of the character.
Right.
The Farrah is the name of the actress. It's not the whatever her Charlie's Angels name was.
Right, which I can't remember at the moment.
I can't either. The future generations could have known the name of one of the angels.
When you go back, futurelings, and find Charlie's Angels reruns, you will understand how revolutionary this hair was. Because all three of those actresses had distinctive haircuts that were sort of defined their character.
Right.
The kind of tomboyish, smart one had...
Sabrina? Is that right?
No,
Kate Jackson wasn't Kate Jackson Sabrina?
Sabrina was the teenage ghost.
Okay. That's wrong on so many levels.
No, I don't remember what their names were, but no, Kate and...
No, her actress is Kate Jackson.
What? Now, wasn't that Janet Jackson?
Almost positive.
Oh, boo.
Although Janet Jackson did popularize the braid she wore in the movie Poetic Justice, but that was a lot later.
Mm-hmm.
We should just mention one not white hairstyle, for crying out loud.
Well, there are plenty of those, but also there are plenty of examples of Halle Berry and black actresses of the 90s and 2000s wearing the Rachel.
Oh, really?
If you go and look at people, I mean, basically the Rachel disseminated throughout the culture so that every Hollywood actress, regardless of race, has a period in their career where they were wearing a version of the Rachel.
Isn't America great that regardless of race, color, or creed, we can all wear the same white suburban hairstyle?
Yeah, pretty
soccer mom haircut.
Pretty extraordinary.
What a country.
I remember in the 1980s trying to feather my hair.
Because men did it too. They wanted the Leif Garrett kind of
Leif Garrett feather. And my hair really resisted feathering because it wanted to be a helmet. I had the bowl haircut where my mom put a mixing bowl over my head and just cut all the hair that stuck out.
The rite of passage.
Right.
You can see all sitcom children of the era had it.
The John Denver haircut.
Give me the John Denver,
Give me the John Denver, which was, actually Dorothy Hamill.
Right.
Had
for
a
women.
Very famous haircut. She was an Olympics figure skater. And had this flouncy, undercurled bob.
And she would twirl on her skates, and it would go whoop,
it would
like a carnival ride.
It would floop out. And that went around the country. Everybody wanted a Dorothy Hamill haircut.
Which might be the only one from the world of sports. I can't think of sports ever giving us another, maybe fashion trend of any kind.
Let's see.
Jordans and stuff. But I mean, hair?
Would
clothing?
You say that... John McEnroe hair ever?
I thought you were going to say John Madden. No,
John
I
Madden's
don't think
hair.
We all have John Madden hair. Actually, maybe that's a very white perspective. Maybe that's not true at all. And maybe people do want whatever the sports hero has.
I mean,
that's what they take to the barbershop.
It will be interesting to, I mean, I'm not sure about that, whether, where the style of kind of cutting the stripe
into
hair,
the buzz cut kind of a,
that, whether that came from sport or not, I'm not sure. I mean, it seems like short hair is just how sports figures wear their hair. It stays out of your eyes. Although maybe Julius Erving introduced
it's true. Maybe more people had afros because of the ABA.
But I think that happened. I think that was culturally, that came from the 60s.
Right.
Anyway, so there are plenty of instances, right, where a hairstyle sweeps the nation. But the Rachel had the greatest lasting impact.
How so?
Well, because it's still, I mean, you don't see Farrah Fawcett hair now, or really Dorothy Hamill hair, but you see Rachel, you see the Rachel everywhere.
But in accordance with your previous theory, that's because maybe it's less of a fashion forward look at me look. You know, the Rachel is a softer, more chameleonic kind of a thing. It's not, it's less of a statement. And therefore has aged a little better?
Well, at the time, it seemed like the whole hair world had been turned upside down. And I can't emphasize enough what a startling look it was in its moment, even maybe more so than the Farrah or the Dorothy Hamill. And yet, I think the mistake that people made was thinking that it looked good on everyone. Really, what I think a big part of why it was fashionable is that people identified with the character of Rachel Green.
Because it's not the Jennifer.
It's not the Jennifer.
Partly because she wasn't that big a star then, right?
Right, and no one knew. This was before she'd married Brad Pitt. It was before she had very much of a of what became her pop culture personality.
Sure. People probably thought of it as Rachel's haircut on Friends, not the haircut Jennifer Aniston wears in her role on Friends.
I think so. And Rachel on Friends was initially a kind of spoiled, like her introduction, the first episode of Friends, she shows up in her wedding dress, having left her betrothed
right,
at the altar. And she's never considered living an independent life outside of her father's money and her husband's money. And she's decided to leave it all behind and run off to the city to be with her friend Courtney Cox and get a job at a cafe and be this sort of freewheeling young woman in the city and discover herself.
Daddy, I can't marry him. I'm sorry. I just don't love him. Well, it matters to me. Come on, Daddy, listen to me. It's like all of my life, everyone has always told me, you're a shoe. And then today I just stopped and I said, what if I don't want to be a shoe? What if I want to be a purse, you know, or a hat? No, I don't want you to buy me a hat. I'm saying that I am a hat. It's a metaphor, Daddy.
Every other character on Friends has kind of a one-line pitch, right? Monica's the neatnik.
Right.
And Phoebe's sort of the flake.
Right.
Joey's a himbo. Chandler's the sarcastic one. Ross is sort of neurotic.
Neurotic and, yes, smart, I guess.
Because he's a paleontologist or something.
Like, he has a real job.
A real job that people have. You
right.
Know, as you know, he's the paleontologist on the floor of your apartment. But what is Rachel's...
Right.
Thing?
What is Rachel's
what is,
thing?
What is the pitch of Rachel?
I think the first pitch of the Rachel Green character was I really self-identify as like,
wow, that was very revealing there, John.
She was the spoiled rich girl I think not explicitly Jewish, but her name is Rachel Green.
That's a little late for a Jewish American princess, right? Isn't that a little offensive in 1990, whatever?
I think in 1991 or two, she was the first Jewish American princess to be a star on television. This is before The Nanny.
But that's like, to me, that's an 80s trope, you know, Private Benjamin and all this stuff.
Right. But this was, I mean, it takes about 10 years for that stuff to go to sitcom.
Isn't that great that she finally assimilated?
And it's never, she never once on the show says, I am Jewish or says, we're celebrating Hanukkah or anything of the kind.
The one where they have Yom Kippur.
But it's implied, I think, broadly implied, that she's kind of the assimilated Jewish character on the show. Although, you know, Ross is also...
Yeah, I mean, isn't his dad Elliot Gould? I mean, Ross seems like sort of the Woody Allen mold, neurotic Jewish guy out of time.
It's funny because the Friends was... its companion show in the culture at the time was Seinfeld.
And that was the in the know. That's what the one you liked.
That's one that the smarter, older
right.
kids
oh,
liked.
Oh, no, I watched Seinfeld. I didn't see Friends.
Yeah, Friends was for teens, and Seinfeld was for us grown-up sophisticates who listen to jazz. But Seinfeld, like, you know, George Costanza is given this sort of Italian backstory right. or whatever, but he's clearly a Jewish character. It's a very Jewish show.
Sure.
Whereas,
and that's often called the genius of Seinfeld, that they, you know... They dressed Jewish comedy up in WASPy names and never referred to it. And so they, you know, they kept the sensibility without scaring anyone off.
Yeah, right. I mean, Kramer, they just sort of gave him this, the name of some goofy guy that was doing tours of lower Manhattan. But Friends, again, was very, like, generally had a very WASPy sheen.
Absolutely.
But so Rachel was the fun one. The cute one, and I think that's a big part of why she was so widely identified with.
Well, she kind of becomes the everywoman, right? Not having a one-sentence pitch makes her, that's what you would be if you were hanging out with them. You'd be Rachel.
Sure, you could go in and put yourself in those shoes.
Right.
Whereas, like, for instance, people would say to me, oh, you're the Chandler.
I got that too, and I hate it.
That you were Chandler? I mean, we're clearly neither Ross or Joey.
Right. Are those your only three choices as a man in the 1990s?
I guess so. We're not Bohunks.
You're either dumb, nervous, or Chandler.
Or shitty.
Yeah. Or mean to your friends.
And within the I guess what we would call the Sex in the City-fication of which girl are you?
Right.
Pre-Sex
which probably
Sex
does
in
not
city.
Predate Sex in the City, actually. I mean, I can't think of another show.
Well, Charlie's Angels. Like, which one of the angels are you?
Maybe I'm a little too young, but I don't remember those conversations.
Yeah, because there was this...
Weren't those just hair color?
The smart business-like one. Pharaoh was the glamorous and a little bit sort of maybe the ditzy one. And then there was the middle one was somewhat in between.
Jacqueline Smith, who I don't remember, or Cheryl Ladd, I guess. No, Cheryl Ladd replaced Farrah Fawcett.
Yeah, right. But also on the show Three's Company, there were only two gals. But
I saw myself as Jack Tripper in that case.
Well, yeah, there's only one guy.
I was not a Chrissy or a whatever Joy Stewart's name is. Janet.
Janet. So Chrissy was blonde and dumb, and Janet had short, dark hair, looked like Liza Minnelli, and was smart and businesslike.
It is problematic, right? There's two women in the world. The dumb blonde one and the smart brunette one.
That's right. The smart, short brunette one that maybe isn't that cute. You can't really tell.
But hey, we can't have two dumb blondes. That would be weird and redundant.
And so if you were looking at Friends and trying to identify yourself, I mean, Phoebe is pretty flaky.
Like who thinks I'm a Phoebe?
Yeah.
Like what kind of a sociopath do you have to be?
I'm sure there were plenty of people. And then Monica is so neurotic and so irritating. Although earlier today, you indicated when asked, which of the Friends girls did you think was the one for you? You
right.
said,
I'm a Monica man.
A Monica.
I called him.
Oh.
Yes. Well, I got his machine and I left a message. But it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. Because, you know, it was like a casual, breezy message. It was breezy. Oh, God, what if it wasn't breezy?
Well, how could it not be breezy? No, because you're in such a breezy place.
I got it. I will play my message for you guys, and you can tell me if it's breezy enough.
Look, Monica, how are you going to do that?
I know the code to his answering machine.
And I guess what I mean is I'm a Courtney Cox person. I'm, you know, Courtney Cox is closer to a physical ideal for me. But I'm not put off by Monica wanting to keep her apartment neat. For crying out loud, John, clean up your apartment.
But there's a sense that Courtney Cox was really playing herself in that show and that she personally is annoying.
Oh, do you think? I don't know if I have any sense of what it would be like to hang out with Courtney Cox. You think she'd always be straightening the magazines on the coffee table?
Yeah, maybe a little bit controlling, a little bit nitpicky.
I'm okay with that. Plan the date, Courtney.
Yeah, see, I'm not that way.
Like, that's how it worked out with David Arquette. He sort of seems like sort of slubby slacker type.
Yeah.
And he needed somebody to whip him into shape.
Needs somebody to tell him to pay his bills and open his mail.
It doesn't seem fair that she had to hyphenate, though. He should have been David Arquette Cox.
Oh.
I think.
Arquette Cox.
Cox
Arquette? Arquette Cox. I guess that resonates.
So I recently read that comedian Jay Mohr, you know Jay Mohr from Saturday Night Live and Jerry Maguire?
Oh, yeah.
He married a sitcom actress named Nikki Cox and decided to take her name in sort of modern egalitarian fashion.
Right.
And he decided to become Jay Cox Mohr. He's a comedian who did not choose the funnier order of Jay Mohr Cox. What a missed opportunity, Jay Mohr.
Jay Mohr Cox. Yeah, I mean, that actually, if you took the hyphen out and just changed your name to Moorcox, that feels like the name of a British explorer, right? Somebody that the third guy to the South Pole was Jay Moorcox.
It's an explorer who could also be a gay porn star, though.
True.
Sure.
It would be easy to turn his exploration adventures into a porn film.
Right. The porn version of that is very easy to imagine.
I feel like Cox Arquette sounds like a neurological disorder. Like, yeah. You know, I have Cox Arquette syndrome.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Cox Arquette. Only one in 600,000 people gets Cox Arquette.
Yeah, they're never going to make a medication for it because it just isn't cost effective.
Maybe if some quarterback son gets Cox Arquette, then we'll finally get a cure. So you're saying that your physical type is not Courtney Cox on any level or personality type. You were a Rachel man from the get-go?
I think I was. I tried very hard to like Phoebe, but I just never felt any chemistry with her.
I'm sure she would say the same.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. There are a lot of people that feel chemistry with me that,
unbeknownst
that
to you,
isn't reciprocated.
You never know.
Now, what's interesting about Friends and the Rachel is that they were almost more... I think maybe truly were more popular in the United Kingdom than in America.
Interesting.
It is a phenomenon in the UK that Friends, both at the time and now in the present day, represent something to them that maybe even Americans can't quite get the whole sense of.
Youth? Is it?
I think it's a version of America that's popular. You know, the United Kingdom has a fascination with America, just as we have a fascination with them.
They watch our movies and they see mailboxes and fire hydrants and manholes with steam coming out, and they want to visit and see that.
Yeah, and I think that Friends offered a vision of New York that actually felt pretty spacious. There was lots of elbow room, and you could kind of go outside. The few times they went outside, it seemed like there was lots of room on the sidewalks. And they had these big apartments. But also, there's a British idea of Americans that we are friendly, outgoing, open.
To a fault.
Yeah. And the characters, the cast of Friends, are all talking about their feelings. They're very generous to one another emotionally, supportive. And I think within the UK, that feels exotic.
You've got a support group, you know, people in and out of each other's homes in their 20s and
like a family.
Yeah.
But not, but they're family. No one's really related except for Monica and Ross.
It does seem like Europeans in general have terrible taste in American television. Have you ever had the experiences of, you know, turning on a TV in Europe and seeing that like Baywatch is on in prime time?
It's huge.
Or night, you know. When I lived in Europe in the early 90s, Knight Rider, which had been off the air here for 5 years or something, was still on in primetime.
Yeah.
And I was just mystified.
The Dukes of Hazzard.
Exactly. I was just mystified at what made this kind of children's entertainment, you know, this perpetual adolescent kind of stuff, translate. Was it language?
It's, I think, really that those things capture an idea of America that's very appealing. You know, if you look at magazine advertisements for cigarettes in Europe, often for American cigarettes, Marlboro, for instance, are often just an entire like 2-page spread of a picture of West Texas with nothing there. Just completely wide open space that it's not even the beautiful West. It's not right. Mesas.
That's when you take a nap on a road trip. It's Nevada.
It's just the worst part of the United States where you can see to the horizon and there's not even a cinder block gas station. But those wide open spaces do not exist in Europe, except maybe, you know, the Banat. But even that has little villages speckled throughout, or trees at the very least, periodically.
Sure. They don't have wasteland.
And this is just wasteland. And that is romantic to someone from the UK.
That's just a sure sign that the grass is always greener. You know, nothing about us craves wasteland. But I guess if you don't have it, and, you know, America, the center of the world, does, it seems exotic.
I mean, the first time you really experience wasteland, it is pretty profound. I remember on tour, the first time we went to that part of the country, when you leave New Mexico and head into Texas, you get into this place where there's nothing there except speed limit signs, right? There's zero. The only thing they do is the Texas state cops or the local cops go out and put a speed limit sign that's like 50 miles an hour. And you don't see it until you're going 90.
By design.
You hit this thing and then they're like, boop, and give you some big ticket. I mean, it's the biggest scam in the world. But we actually pulled over in the van and got out just to experience the wind and the lack of, I mean, it's a pretty profound experience, just the lack of any kind of thing to put your hand on except for like a rock with a lizard on it.
My people on my father's side come from Muleshoe, Texas, in the panhandle. That's not the panhandle, actually. It's in the north part where Lubbock is. That's not the panhandle, huh? The panhandle's west.
Well, no, the panhandle...
Is the panhandle the rectangle?
The panhandle
part?
Of Oklahoma is to the west.
It's near the Oklahoma panhandle.
Yeah, but the panhandle of Texas would be the top part.
Oh, you think it's the square thing that goes north?
Yeah, if you're going to hold Texas by a handle.
I think I would hold it by the thing sticking into New Mexico.
Well, the thing sticking into New Mexico is that's its nose, right? It's its pan nose, the famous pan nose of Texas.
I guess I never thought about where I would hold Texas.
If you're going to hold Oklahoma, you hold it clearly by the handle, but I always thought that Texas also was held by the square part.
So I have that kind of bleak one windmill plains in my blood, but I've never been to the place where my great-grandfather owned the Muleshoe General Store.
Oh, you should go.
I need to recover my panhandle heritage.
You know, they talk about big sky Montana, but when you get to Montana, the sky really is bigger.
What do you think it is?
It's just that there's nothing on the horizon. There's nothing to interfere with it, right? You don't see anything but sky. It's 60% of what you have to work with rather than 40%.
I like sky. I'm not against it, but I feel like I know what it gives me. I'm never walking around thinking, I wish I could see more of the sky.
Well,
right,
they have
now
really tall clouds too. So you get a sense of how tall the sky
do
is.
Do like a really tall cumulonimbus kind of a cloud.
Right.
That's
I
a good
too
day. Those big Maxfield Parrish clouds.
Yeah. We don't see those here where we live because they're obscured by
the low
mist
gray clouds. Do you think that Friends would translate to different languages? Like, do the French or the Central Europeans like Friends?
I think so. I think it would. It's not like it's, I mean, that's the thing about Seinfeld. There's a lot of colloquialism.
Sure, comedy is impossible to translate and still get the laugh.
But the thing about Friends is that the comedy is pretty broad, pretty bland. Like, it's oh, true. Monica's nervous. Lol. It's not like, it's not Monica's like using very much subtlety to communicate that. It's not very psychological.
And the one character trait thing probably works for you. There's nothing particularly American about being a flake or about being sarcastic, I don't
right
think.
Well, and Ross at one point has a pet monkey. Like, that's pretty broad humor.
We would not buy that in a sitcom, in any kind of comedy today.
No, and the thing is, whoever had a pet monkey?
No one in New York has a pet monkey.
If you could, you would, right? I mean, if you could have a pet monkey, I mean, there wouldn't be so many goths walking around with ferrets. On that note, let's take a little moment. But I do feel like when I think of the Rachel, I think of it as now kind of a UK haircut.
Oh, do you see it more then?
Yeah, if you go to the United Kingdom, you'll see the Rachel, and it represents sort of a similar but slightly different thing there.
But haven't they heard that it's, you know, been 20 years and there are other haircuts now? Like, they must have seen the later seasons of Friends, if nothing else.
They definitely, I think, sophisticated people in the UK feel the same way that sophisticated people in America feel about Friends, which is that it's a show for teenagers or nostalgic Generation Xers. But there are a lot of those in the UK, and I think it represents an earlier time where there still were television programs that had no diversity at all. I mean, the only diversity on Friends is this one is more nervous than that one, but they're all white, early 20s, and presenting a kind of affluence, if in no other way than just that they have all this leisure.
And it's unapologetic, you know?
It is.
It was not an issue at the time. Did you notice that all six of them are white?
Yeah, nobody
like,
ever.
And of course, all six of them are white.
Exactly.
As it should be.
No like one ever reflected on their privilege. Right. Nobody of any other race even stopped by.
Isn't
until later in the show.
Right.
I mean, there was
Is there a Gabriel Union appearance?
Part of the problem here is that you and I really haven't watched Friends. We are just culturally aware of Friends.
I'm so glad we're speaking to people in the future who have no idea what it even is, and not a vast audience who has tons of Friends knowledge and is aware of every time we make a Friends misstep.
Right,
because
right
they have every episode on DVD.
The thing that's important about Friends is that it also was, the Rachel wasn't just the last haircut, but Friends was among the last sitcoms that truly captured a national zeitgeist. After Friends went off the air, Friends was the number one show for many years. After it went off the air, immediately the number one show was a reality show, where it was America's Top Model or America's Best Quiche, or
it was probably Survivor or Millionaire,
something like that. And since that time, the number one show has consistently been a reality-based program. There's never been another sitcom to get to the number one slot.
There, yeah, comedy is not a monoculture anymore. There's, it's so niche. You know, you want the comedy that appeals to you, and you were almost insulted by the idea that you might be watching something that 80 million people are laughing at.
Right. And you have Sex in the City, which is a comedy sort of sitcom, but it was on premium TV. I mean, again, it was all white protagonists, and it appealed to a certain sort of demographic. It wasn't a broadly watched show.
I just looked into this for something I'm writing. There have been times in American history where 22 of the top 30 shows were sitcoms.
Hmm.
Like NBC in the 80s, must-see TV,
yeah,
kind of a thing. The Cosby Show, Cheers era. 22 of the top 30 shows were comedies. Do you know how many last year?
How many?
One.
See?
One of the top 30 shows was a comedy, and it was Big Bang Theory.
That's extraordinary.
And comedy's more popular than ever. It's not a sign of the downfall of comedy. It's just a sign of the end of the monoculture.
Yeah, end of the three networks.
The end of mass comedy.
There were 54 million viewers on a regular basis of Friends. 54 million people out of 300 million Americans.
All watching it at the same time. It's a communal experience.
Yeah.
When you hear that laugh track, that's America laughing at the same time.
And that is gone. And the idea that there would be a haircut from a television show that I would be personally aware of now.
Sure. Pick the most influential show. You do not see people getting the Game of Thrones haircut. Give me the Tyrion Lannister. It's just, it doesn't influence fashion or anything the way it used to.
I think it's evidenced in a lot of aspects, right? Like in the 1950s and 60s, there was a new car design for every single make of cars every 2 or 3 years. You know, the Pontiac Tempest of 1964 and the Pontiac Tempest of 1968 looked nothing like one another. It was completely redesigned because the sense was that if you were trying to sell cars to somebody 3 years later, it needed to be a whole new look in order to appeal to the buyers. You couldn't just keep foisting the same car off on them. That was just the sense of what people wanted. And it was only in the 80s when all of a sudden you started to see these cars that had a 10-year lifespan where the car didn't really change over time.
It's more efficient.
And now we see a Toyota Camry. It just looks like a breath lozenge for 15, 20 years. I mean, the Prius keeps changing its taillights, but the brand is the style.
It's also a sign of the downfall of celebrity culture. You know, we live in more of a egalitarian age where social media and reality TV give us the idea that anybody can be a celebrity, you know? It's not like, the whole hairstyle thing goes back to Madame Pompadour in the 18th century. Hmm. You know, this courtier of King Louis XV, who gets such an influential haircut that people, it's still named after her almost 300 years later.
The Pompadour.
Yeah, Elvis and Little Richard and Janelle Monáe, you know, they all have a haircut that a French courtier made famous in the 1750s just because she was sleeping with the king.
Interesting that it became a male haircut.
Right. Most of them don't switch. I don't know. I've never seen a guy with the Rachel.
No, who wasn't like a bass player in a sort of hip hop metal band.
Maybe Viggo Mortensen in the Lord of the Rings movies has a variant of the Rachel. I don't know. But now I just think, you know, that would never, you know, the days of the started with Madame Pompadour, the beginning of modern celebrity, and maybe ended with the Rachel are now past us. And it's no longer, I want to look like that glamorous face up on the big screen or the little screen.
And maybe also the rise of alternative culture.
Sure. I want to fit in my niche.
And you fit in within your niche. Like if you're a goth, you're going to wear goth clothes that were invented arguably goth culture was invented in the early 80s, but it was referencing things from the way beyond Bela Lugosi. But if you dressed like Robert Smith in 1983, right now, you would be identifiable as a goth, and that's the uniform.
In the 90s, nobody wanted the goth Rachel. Give me the goth Rachel. Give me the grunge Rachel, they'd say.
I think so. Isn't that what Winona Ryder was wearing for a long time, the goth Rachel? I think there are plenty of examples of the Rachel being repurposed. You know, there's the Meg Ryan Rachel. There's the Rachel that was worn by Winona or Tia Leone, or I mean, everyone's had it, right? So there's a Rachel for all seasons.
And that concludes the Rachel. Entry number 1024.GN2917 in the omnibus. We do not believe that social media will exist in your era, listeners, but you should know that at one time in your distant past, our tweets were archived at Omnibus Project. I tweeted as at Ken Jennings. John was at John Roderick. He was also on Instagram under that same handle. People could even email us using what now seems to you, I'm sure, a very archaic form of electronic communication.
Although maybe not. Maybe people are still emailing, or maybe giant futurelings are still emailing each other.
Sent from my telepathic iPhone. Mm-hmm. Our address was theomnibuspodcast@gmail.com.
We honestly have no way of knowing how long our civilization will survive. Perhaps you futurelings are just future iterations of ourselves. You may be wearing the Rachel even now, or you may be wearing the haircut which has come to be known as the Ken Jennings, which still costs $27.
Inflation adjusted.
We hope that this civilization-ending catastrophe may never come, but it may also come in our very near future.
This could be my last haircut.
If it done this, and I could stop cutting my hair as of tomorrow because I am immolated in a ball of fire.
Because why? You know, why bother when the ball of fire is coming?
If it comes soon, this recording, like everything we produce, may be our final word. But if, in fact, we survive, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.